Today is Wednesday, May 12th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Israel beefs up security forces near Gaza. Plus, Russia denies role in cyber attack of critical U.S. oil pipeline.
The FBI says DarkSide, a criminal group based in Russia or Eastern Europe, is responsible.
Also, the Red Cross warns of surging COVID cases in Asia. These stories and more are next. Israel has beefed up military forces near Gaza, the military said on Wednesday, as hostilities between Israel and Hamas escalated, with at least 40 killed in Gaza and 5 in Israel, in the most intensive aerial exchanges in years. Israel carried out hundreds of airstrikes in Gaza into Wednesday morning, the third day in the flare-up of violence, as Hamas and other Palestinian militants fired multiple rocket barrages at Tel Aviv and the southern city of Beersheba. Israel said its jets had targeted and killed several Hamas intelligence leaders early in the day. Other strikes targeted what the military said were rocket launch sites, Hamas offices, and the homes of Hamas leaders. However, Palestinian authorities said many of the targets were civilian offices and homes. The conflict has become heaviest fighting between Israel and Hamas since the 2014 war in Gaza and has prompted international concern that the situation could spiral out of control. That's the sound of a rocket barrage into Israeli territory. The United States is calling on Israel and Palestinian leaders to de-escalate and reduce tensions amid deadly Hamas rocket attacks and Israeli airstrikes following clashes in Jerusalem. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more on this latest foreign policy challenge for the Biden administration.
Hamas militants said they launched 130 rockets toward the Israeli city of Tel Aviv Tuesday evening, to retaliate for an Israeli airstrike that destroyed a 12-story building in Gaza City in the Palestinian territories. The nighttime rocket attacks are viewed as a major escalation of an already volatile situation. At least 28 Palestinians, including 9 children, have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza since Monday, and at least 122 others have been wounded. Medical officials say at least 3 Israelis have been killed and at least 56 have been treated at hospitals as a result of Hamas rocket strikes. The U.S. State Department is urgently calling on both sides to de-escalate the conflict. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
We are deeply concerned about the escalation between Israel and those launching rockets from Gaza, and we call for restraint and for calm. Israel has the right to defend itself and to respond to rocket attacks. The Palestinian people also have the right to safety and security, just as Israelis do. We are also deeply concerned about the reported loss of life in Gaza and Israel, including the deaths of children, as well as many innocent civilians injured.
Asked about criticism by some that the U.S. has failed to show leadership as attacks escalate, State Department spokesperson Ned Price had this to say.
Well, I would respond to that criticism, Matt, by noting that the United States is doing what we can, knowing that our ability in certain situations is going to be, in some cases, limited.
With disturbing images of both Palestinians and Israelis running for their lives, experts say leadership and diplomacy have vital roles to play. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Russia has denied involvement in the cyber attack that crippled Colonial Pipeline, a critical artery for almost half of the U.S. East Coast fuel supply. While the Biden administration has taken steps to address gasoline shortages, drivers are beginning to see higher prices at the pump. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this story.
As officials sought to soothe concerns about fuel supply, some Americans are already paying more at the pump.
It's just one more thing that takes us into major stress.
Colonial Pipeline, which delivers almost half the petroleum fuel consumed on the U.S. East Coast, stopped operations last week due to a ransomware attack. These are cyber attacks where malicious actors seeking a financial payout hold hostage companies and government's networks, paralyzing their service. The FBI says DarkSide, a criminal group based in Russia or Eastern Europe, is responsible. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We'll wait for our intelligence community to make a full assessment before we have more to convey about it.
DarkSide said it only wants to make money and has no interest in geopolitics. On Tuesday, Russian government spokesperson Dmitry Peskov denied involvement.
We strongly object to any accusations against us in relation to this.
In April, the Biden administration slapped sanctions on Russia for involvement in the SolarWinds cyber attack targeting federal agencies. Cyber experts say an international accord, preferably one including Russia, is needed to halt ransomware attacks. Meg King is director of the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Wilson Center.
Unless we can find a way to stop the business model, to make it harder for these criminal groups based in Russia and surrounding regions to hack and get companies to pay to release their data, unless we can help companies to have data backups, unless we can help critical infrastructure operators understand what their risks are, then this problem will continue.
Colonial Pipeline said it's working to restore services. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has taken steps to address fuel shortages, including temporarily allowing lower-quality gasoline blends to boost supply and enlisting rail operators to transport fuels to areas that need it most. Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm.
It's not that we have a gasoline shortage. It's that we have this supply crunch and that things will be back to normal soon.
If needed, the administration is also preparing to waive a federal rule that requires fuel shipped between U.S. ports to be transported on ships built, owned, and operated by Americans. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The United States improved from 48th to 44th last year in the Reporters Without Borders 2020 Press Freedom Ranking, but violent incidents committed by both authorities and civilians against journalists prompted law enforcement to team up with a nonprofit to de-escalate tensions before tempers run over. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
For journalists in Washington, the year started with the storming of the United States Capitol in January. Then a pro-Trump mob tore down barricades and attacked journalists in their gear. That violence against journalists followed a summer in which millions protested the police killing of George Floyd, and police clashed sometimes violently with protesters and press. So Georgia law enforcement officials and the Georgia chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, or SPJ, saw the opportunity for a teaching moment.
What we have here is a protest situation where police are needing to defuse the protesters. They're entering an area where they shouldn't, or things are starting to get violent and they need to. It's no longer peaceful.
I'm here live on the scene of a protest.
Former president of the Georgia SPJ, Charlotte Norsworth, appears in this training video as a reporter before a mock crowd of protesters hostile toward police. The course at the Georgia Public Safety Training Center guides law enforcement to de-escalation instead of conflict, but it also teaches journalists to respect legal boundaries. Chad Wilson is division director for basic training. He says the program helps bridge the divide between law enforcement and media.
You really get to see that it's, you know, it's not just a person with a microphone in your face, or it's not just a person with a camera. From our perspective, you know, they're human beings just like we are. And then from the media perspective, I think it's also important that they got to see that, you know, there's a human being standing behind that shield wearing that helmet. And at the end of the day, we all want to just do our job.
Both Norsworth and Wilson agree there is growing mistrust between journalists and law enforcement as police have increasingly become the subject of protest. Still, both are quick to call this training a well-received step in the right direction. Wilson says the training also exposes officers from more rural areas to media presence they would typically not encounter. The physical program is new, but online training modules are available to all Georgia law enforcement. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Bangladesh is seeing a rise in the number of female journalists being harassed by fundamentalist groups, raising security concerns for reporters out on assignment. VOA's Sanjana Feroz has more.
Mobs surrounding and harassing media during protests by fundamentalist or Islamist groups. Bangladesh is seeing more incidents like this, prompting female journalists and their news managers to rethink personal safety and the risk of covering some stories. Earlier this year, members of the Hifazat-e-Islam Islamist group attacked Ghazi TV's Rubina Yasmin during protests against a visit by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Some activists came to me and asked why I was dressed in men's clothes. I did not want to engage in any argument at that moment, fearing for my life, even though I was wearing a bulletproof vest. They complained that I was not wearing a veil.
It is becoming difficult for women journalists in Bangladesh to survive, says Nadia Sherman, a crime reporter for Channel 71.
Women journalists are usually seen as not so important. Very few media outlets in Bangladesh have moved away from that notion. Many media officials are proud to say that their organization does not hire women.
Female journalists are doing good work, and dedication, professionalism are driving them forward, says Shakil Ahmed, head of news for Channel 71. But Ahmed says he worries about the risk of attack out in the field.
I have to think multiple times before signing a woman on a risky assignment. Even 5 years back, they could easily cover these kinds of assignments, but now the scenario has changed a lot. My worry is the lifelong impact a mob attack could have on a female reporter.
The risk factor in assigning a female journalist to some stories is impacting the fight for equality, says journalist Ishrat Jahan Urmi.
When women are being physically attacked and have life-threatening injuries, how can one fight for equal rights? I think these incidents are instigating women to stop fighting for their rights.
Despite the challenges, women journalists in Bangladesh say they will keep working to win their fight for equality. Sanjana Feroz, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America. Germany's environment minister says the government is considering additional spending to meet the new climate targets it has set for the coming decade. Avenger Schulz told public broadcaster ARD that officials agree that urgent measures are needed to complement the new goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 65% from 1990 levels by 2030 and of being net zero by 2045. The more ambitious targets were hastily agreed on last week after Germany's top court ruled that existing measures placed too much of the burden of curbing global warming on younger people. The International Federation of the Red Cross says coronavirus cases have exploded in Asia in the past 2 weeks, with over 5.9 million new infections. It says more people have been diagnosed with illness in Asia over the past 2 weeks than in Americas, Europe, and Africa combined. The Red Cross warned Wednesday that the surge is pushing hospitals and health systems to the brink of collapse. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The deadly second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic ravaging India has spread across its borders to neighboring Nepal. This small mountain kingdom now confronts a crisis as its healthcare system buckles under the pressure. Anjana Patricia has the details.
Seeking a safe haven, thousands of Nepalese migrants working in India fled home as a brutal second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic battered the country with sickness and death. Now Nepal is witnessing similar scenes. Its fragile healthcare system is buckling as infections and deaths spike exponentially.
Almost all hospitals are packed. Some hospitals have some spaces, but we are unable to operationalize almost all of them because of shortage of oxygen and shortage of other logistics.
India and Nepal have open borders, allowing easy mobility between the two countries. While cases first surged in towns along the Indian border, Kathmandu Valley is now the epicenter. Many have fled the city in recent days, raising fears that they will carry the deadly infection into villages.
Number of people dying on searching the hospitals, on the treatment, during the treatments. And another alarming situation that the large number of people are in home isolations. And once they seek for the hospital care, we are not such a, in such a good condition that we can provide the their required care.
Many say, like India, Nepal too let down its guard when infections were low, allowing large gatherings. Now, doctors are warning of an impending crisis in a country with very few intensive care beds.
We are underprepared, under-resourced, and under-capacitated to perform anything that is expected.
Most flights have been halted, and much of the country is in lockdown. Worried residents are lining up for inoculations, but less than 7% has received one dose. Health officials and doctors feared that without help, the situation will only worsen in the coming days. Anjana Pusricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
A fully robotic kitchen with a robot chef that can cook thousands of dishes could be a game changer in homes and restaurants around the world. VOA's Julie Tebo has more.
Who hasn't dreamt of having their own personal chef to whip up tasty meals at a moment's notice? Well, now there's a robot for that. Molly Robotic Kitchen with a robot cook can create thousands of dishes with the skill of a master chef, says its inventor, Mark Olenek.
That's the idea behind of this kitchen. When you have get freshly cooked meal, anytime you need, day and night, from the good number of potential choices.
The robot draws from a database of thousands of recipes and is programmed to mimic the movements of a real chef.
Because of how it's based on human hands, it's got the potential to do just about any job in the kitchen. And that would open up all kinds of possibilities for the chefs to do other things and be more creative, I think.
It's not because humans can't do the same job, says Olenek.
It's because the machine is very good for copying and reproducing things. And the machine not make a lot of mistakes. Machine can work 24/7. And the productivity of machine is much bigger.
And it's also multifunctional.
If you want to have frying station, it will do fry. If you want to have like a pasta station, we can do pasta. If you want to do risotto, we can do risotto. Doesn't matter what you can put inside, machine can operate it.
Olenek's motivation for his invention?
Food. I'm a food lover. I want to have this food just when I want it, not when I can get it.
Which is the whole idea behind the kitchen.
I'd just be happy to see people around the world eating the same food that I love. And I think that genuinely will bring people together around the world.
Julie Tabo, VOA News.
The United Nations warns Somalia faces a perilous future as drought followed by torrential rains have destroyed this year's planting season. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Somalia is one of the countries in the world most prone to the erratic and calamitous impacts of climate change. It has been hit by a double climate disaster for more than 2 weeks that is likely to worsen its already acute situation of food insecurity. The drought, which was declared on April 25th, was soon followed by torrential rains that caused flash floods and rivers to overflow. The UN Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the rains came too late for the planting season. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says floods have killed at least 25 people in various parts of the country. The victims include 9 children who died when their house flooded in the Benadir region in the capital, Mogadishu.
The Juba River has burst its banks, houses have been washed away, and livestock have perished. There are also reports of flooding in the north of the country, and there are continuous flash flood warnings across Somalia, especially for people living in low-lying areas. In flooded areas, local communities are struggling to prevent further flooding by placing sandbags, poles, and other materials to reinforce riverbanks.
The World Food Programme reports 2.7 million Somalis are short of food, with more than 500,000 on the brink of famine. An estimated 300,000 children under age 5 are malnourished, including 48,000 who are severely malnourished and at high risk of disease and death. Archer's spokesman Lyerke warns the combined impact of drought and floods is likely to worsen this critical situation.
Both climate shocks cause displacement, jeopardize access to safe water, increase waterborne diseases, and impact people's livelihoods. Despite increasing humanitarian needs, the funding forecast for 2021 is the worst in 6 years. This year's Somalia Humanitarian Response Plan requires $1 billion US dollars to assist 4 million people. As of today, the plan is only 19% funded.
Lyerke says OCHA and partners are using the limited funds at their disposal to step up operations in drought-affected areas and reach at least 353,000 people with aid. Urgent efforts, he adds, also are underway to respond to the flash flooding. The World Food Program reports it has distributed food to more than 20,000 people in Jowar City, one of the areas hardest hit by flooding in central Somalia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkey's foreign minister is visiting Saudi Arabia in a bid to repair deeply strained relations. The visit is part of broader regional efforts by Ankara to stem its growing isolation in the region. Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul.
The visit comes as the escalating rivalry between the two countries plunges relations to an historic low, with Turkey at one point accusing Saudi Arabia of enforcing a trade embargo. Turkish presidential adviser Mesut Çavuşoğlu says Ankara is now looking for a reset.
Ankara is looking closer ties with Saudi Arabia, beneficial for the regional peace and security. And Saudi Arabia, you know that, very important for Turkey. But there are positive atmosphere and an intention to repair. First, improve the economic relations in trade side. Saudi Arabia, the ban in some of the Turkish products, is not very good for Turkey. We have to repair this situation.
Riyadh denies enforcing an embargo, but Ankara claims exports to the kingdom had fallen by 90% in the last year. Observers say Erdogan and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman have been competing for regional leadership in the Middle East. Following the 2018 murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Erdogan led international calls to hold Riyadh to account. Hüseyin Barca, head of the Ankara-based Foreign Policy Institute, said Erdogan has ceased those efforts.
Tayyip Erdogan has realized that this policy cannot continue. They see that the cooperation is more important, not confrontation, but cooperation. Tayyip Erdogan's personal sympathy for Saudi Arabia as an Islamist was always there. For him, not to have good relations with Saudi Arabia is not acceptable.
Ankara also sees Riyadh as playing an essential role in its bid to repair relations with Egypt. Last week, high-level Turkish and Egyptian talks in Cairo to restore full diplomatic ties appear to have made little progress. Turkish media reports citing Egyptian officials speaking anonymously say Cairo is pressing for a withdrawal of Turkish forces from Libya and the extradition of Egyptian regime opponents living in Turkey. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Iran's former hardline president Mohammad Ahmadinejad has registered to run again for the Islamic Republic's presidency. His decision Wednesday raises the possibility that the populist leader who rapidly advanced Tehran's nuclear program to challenge the West could return to the country's top civilian post, while Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned Ahmadinejad off from the running in 2017. That hasn't happened this time. That means Ahmadinejad may join the wide open election to replace the relative moderate president Hassan Rouhani. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
What are the chances there will be a second wave of COVID-19 cases later this year?
Well, it's impossible to predict with any degree of certainty what's going to happen.
Plus, a veteran police officer responds to the defund the police movement.
Defunding to us means that you want to do away with us.
Those stories and more coming up at 1705 UTC on V.